Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society, is made possible in part by the Department of State, Division of Historical Resources, and the State of Florida. It's also made possible by the Jesse Ball DuPont Fund and by the historic Rossiter House Museum and Gardens in O'Galley, celebrating pioneer history, the natural environment, and women's history. Available for weddings and events at rossiterhousemuseum.org. This is Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society, online at myfloridahistory.org. I'm Ben Brotmarkle, and coming up on the program, Opera Orlando is staging an adaptation of the children's book The Secret River by Florida writer Marjorie Kinnan Rawlings.
It's a Florida story by a Florida author, a Florida composer, so we're really just proud of it.
We'll discuss Florida civil defense in World War II.
The American home front in World War II was no longer as isolated from the dangers of military action as had been the case in World War I.
And we'll talk about the Black political independent movement after Reconstruction. All that ahead on Florida Frontiers. Opera Orlando commissioned the new work, The Secret River, based on a children's book by Florida writer Marjorie Kinnan Rawlings, best known for her Pulitzer Prize-winning novel, The Yearling. The opera was written by Pulitzer Prize and Grammy-winning librettist Mark Campbell and University of Central Florida Pegasus professor and composer Stella Sung. A new production of The Secret River will be performed on the Grove Stage in Mead Botanical Garden in Winter Park, March 6th and 7th. Gabriel Pricer is a Grammy Award-winning baritone and executive director of Opera Orlando.
I grew up in Apopka, Florida. I'm a Florida boy. Coming to find out that Stella's a Florida girl. She grew up here in Gainesville. So I think we just hit it off, partially because of that, but because of our love of music, of opera. She had composed a couple operas. We were getting the opera company up and running again, and you know, opera is this tricky art form because it can be a museum piece, and not that that's a negative thing. Opera can just be another museum piece and a traditional production, but there's so many new operas being composed. And in my career, I've been very fortunate to be in some of those new operas. That's what I won the Grammy for, was Fantastic Mr. Fox. Who knew there was an opera about the Roald Dahl book? You know, but there's opera being written all the time, and there's opera that can be written about our lives, our stories, because that's what opera really is. It's our shared humanity. So Stella and I just got to talking about, hey, we should do a new opera. You know, it's very ambitious for a young company to commission something, but I happen to also be friends with Mark Campbell, who's a Pulitzer Prize-winning librettist, opera librettist. I teamed Stella and Mark up. They were willing to work with each other. They really hit it off, and we said we want to find a Florida story.
After considering many options for Florida stories, the Opera Orlando team selected to adapt the Marjorie Kinnan Rawlings children's book, The Secret River. Composer Stella Sung.
Mark and I were thinking about what story, and we were running it by Gabe and the team, and like, oh, should be maybe Ponce de Leon or Disney or, you know, all kinds of whatever.
The Space Coast,
yeah. All kinds of things. And just all weren't quite fitting right. And then one day a friend of mine, I was talking to her on the phone, and she said, oh, I just bought this book by Marjorie Kinnan Rawlings called The Secret River. It's a children's book, and maybe that would be interesting. So we went out, we bought the book, we all fell in love with it, and said, this is it. This is going to be our new opera. And growing up in Gainesville, I went to P.K. Young from kindergarten through high school, and we went to the Rawlings homestead all the time. I mean, it was kind of our field trip. And so I was familiar with Rawlings, of course, but I had never run across this book particularly. And so we just, we loved it. And Mark said, I'm going to go ahead and start writing libretto. And he crafted a beautiful libretto I couldn't have asked for a better collaborator and a beautiful writer, and understood the story, kept the simplicity, and yet there was a complexity underneath about life, about humanity, about family, all those wonderful things. So yeah, that's how we got going.
Mark Campbell has written librettos for dozens of operas, including The Shining, based on the Stephen King novel, and The Manchurian Candidate, based on the Richard Condon novel. Once Campbell provided the libretto for The Secret River, Stella Sung set the story to music.
What Mark gave me was absolutely beautiful, and very, very few changes, at least at the outset, that we needed to do. And so I started writing the music to it. And then we had our first run-through workshop.
A piano workshop.
Piano workshop.
Just piano, yeah.
Yeah, just piano and singers. And then we started collaborating a little bit more, just kind of tweaking and changing a few things here to make it better. Because both Mark and I always felt like, okay, we have our product, but we can improve. We can improve it, and we can change it to make it better, make the story better. And tell the story a little closer. So that's what we did.
What we have is greater than gold. What we have is heaven to hold.
A new production of Opera Orlando's The Secret River will be performed on the Grove stage at Mead Botanical Garden in Winter Park, March 6th and 7th at 7:30 p.m. This is Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society. I'm Ben Brotmarkle. Visit us anytime at myfloridahistory.org to find great books on Florida history and culture, watch our public television series Florida Frontiers, and much more. That's myfloridahistory.org.
Don't sit under the apple tree with anyone else but me. Anyone else but me. Anyone else but me. No, no, no. Don't sit under the apple tree with anyone else but me.
Joining us now is Connie Lester, Associate Professor of History at the University of Central Florida, Director of the Riches Digital Archiving Project, and Editor of the Florida Historical Quarterly. Connie, World War II represents a milestone in American history and is the subject of numerous books and articles. Most of them deal with military actions in the European and Pacific theaters. More recently, historians have focused on the home front, particularly wartime industries and the role of women in producing planes, tanks, and munitions. Little has been written about civil defense in response to total war.
Analysis of the rise of civil defense, a federal initiative that continued into the Cold War and laid the foundations for FEMA, was the subject of an article by John Robert Whitehurst in a 2023 article in the Florida Historical Quarterly. Whitehurst, an independent scholar, provides an overview of the role civil defense played in Florida's World War II experience and argues that the federal agency influenced wartime and later social changes through its efforts to create a climate of unity in support of the war. The American home front in World War II was no longer as isolated from the dangers of military action as had been the case in World War I. Military weaponry placed civilians at greater risk for becoming targets. As civil defense historian Lawrence Vail noted, quote, "With the development of war at a distance involving large-scale and indiscriminate destruction, the non-combatant population has frequently come to suffer the brunt of the effects of war," end quote. Not only did Americans engage in civil defense efforts to thwart enemy plans, they also participated in what Florida historian Gary Mormino described as, quote, "negotiations between racial and ethnic identities with that of patriotism and support for a military response to the spread of fascism in Europe," end quote. Whitehurst argues that civil defense played an important role in that negotiation process. Within the National Office of Civil Defense, differences in viewpoint and focus between the agency's two leading figures, Fiorello LaGuardia and First Lady Eleanor Roosevelt, demonstrated the two civil defense initiatives. For LaGuardia, the principal role of the agencies was the creation of a military-focused program for civilians. For Roosevelt, civil defense required a program based on social welfare, one that would insulate civilians from radical ideologies.
Connie, Floridians are probably most familiar with stories of blackouts, aircraft and submarine spotters, and collections of metal for reuse in defense industries.
Franklin Roosevelt created the Office of Civilian Defense, OCD, in May 1941, prior to the attack on Pearl Harbor. Even before OCD, the Council of National Defense recommended that each state create an advisory defense council and begin coordinating efforts with the federal council. Florida originally approved such a council in April 1940 and provided an initial budget of $50,000. As the U.S. entered the conflict, OCD pamphlets reflecting LaGuardia's concern defined the war as a modern war or total war in which the strategy, quote, contemplates direct attacks against civilian life and institutions in order to crush national morale and disrupt support for defending forces. To combat these tactics, civilians needed to take increasing responsibilities for the protection of the nation and themselves. Civilians must participate in their own defense, end quote. Total war called for total defense. From the civilian perspective, total defense differed substantially from the work of the military and included everything from food rationing to the activities of the Civil Air Patrol. Surrounded by the Atlantic Ocean on the east and the Gulf on the west, Florida citizens experienced all the rationing and collections that engaged the rest of the country, but they also assumed a role in protecting the coastline from assault. Air raid warnings became a fixture in Florida communities. The warnings adopted a signaling system that was color-coded. A yellow alert was a precautionary stage in which only those responsible for warnings were aware. The blue stage was the first public acknowledgement of a possible attack, with a steady, audible signal. The third, or red stage, produced a series of short blasts on public sirens and required specific action depending on the time of day. For example, a night warning required a blackout by homes, businesses, and automobiles. Periodically, communities tested the air raid warning system and the speed of producing a blackout. During warning tests, Boy Scouts in many communities rode their bicycles around town to remind people in homes that remained lit to extinguish the lights. Not everybody was an enthusiastic participant. Some businesses asked for exemptions from the blackout requirements. 20th Century Fox asked permission to hold a bonfire on the Gulf Coast for a movie being filmed there. The Atwood Grapefruit Company asked for an exemption to use bonfires to heat fruit groves during a cold snap. As the war continued, an increasing number of exemption requests were received, mostly for sports events and tourism. Night games at high schools and Major League Baseball games demanded exemption in order to keep up citizen morale. As J.B. Lemon, the president of the East Coast League of Professional Baseball Clubs, said in a letter to Florida Governor Spencer Holland, quote, everyone wants to cooperate with the government's effort to win the war. But public morale is a big factor in time of war. And President Roosevelt has repeatedly declared that he wanted to see baseball operate as it always had, and he didn't care if Griffith Stadium lights were visible 150 miles at sea. He still wanted to see the night baseball in Washington, end quote. What Lemon did not reveal was that night games in New York, Washington, and Southern California were often delayed by blackouts. In 1943, General A.H. Blanding suspended blackouts along the Florida coast, even as he worried that, quote, relaxing of civil defense exercises such as air raid drills and blackouts lulled the general populace into a dangerous assumption a speedy Allied victory was inevitable, end quote. According to Blanding, quote, Florida's civilian defense shifted from air raid defense to defense against sabotage, accident, and natural disasters, end quote. As Whitehurst notes, quote, the shift set precedents for Cold War defense policies that would follow later, end quote.
Creating and sustaining national unity in support of the war was also one of the objectives of the OCD. What do the records show about that effort?
Whitehurst points to the opportunities that the war opened for civilians. A population shift occurs during the war that peace did not reverse. People of all races and ethnic groups move from the countryside to the towns and cities to take better-paying jobs in wartime industries, bringing together ethnic and racial groups to work in areas that had earlier denied them employment. OCD made clear its position that, quote, in a total war, there should be no discrimination based on age, sex, color, race, religion, citizenship, or economic status, end quote. OCD Chairman John Kilgore advised subordinates who gave public presentations on civil defense that they should, quote, not declare this war to be a fight by or for the Anglo-Saxon race, and should avoid sliding references or anecdotes at the expense of racial, religious, or political groups or our allies, end quote. In January 1942, President Roosevelt urged, quote, all private employers to adopt a sane policy regarding aliens and foreign-born citizens, and to remember that the sons of some foreigners they discharge may be among those who fought and are fighting so valiantly at Pearl Harbor and in the Philippines, end quote. Whitehurst notes this inclusivity for immigrants while pointing to the obvious hypocrisy of the internment of Japanese Americans. Despite these admonitions in favor of broad inclusion, Florida's World War II record is more problematic. African Americans joined the Double V campaign to fight for victory against fascism abroad and victory against racism at home. Nevertheless, they continued to struggle against the restrictions imposed by Jim Crow segregation, restrictions that continued after the war. In 1944, the Florida American Legion refused to charter an African American chapter, despite the service of black soldiers in both wars and the work of World War I veterans for civil defense in black communities during World War II. Public fear of returning black soldiers, a sentiment that followed World War I, continued in the aftermath of World War II. Civil defense efforts provided opportunities for many Floridians of all races, but the limitations are worth noting. African-American civil defense workers were expected to remain in their own segregated neighborhoods. Undocumented workers were barred from some defense industries. Initially, women were expected to limit their contributions to home gardens, home canning, renovating of old clothes, and other activities defined as women's work. And yet, as Gary Mormino explained, quote, the Second World War served as a seedbed for the modern civil rights movement, end quote. Many of the leaders of the movement were World War II veterans. As Whitehurst concludes, quote, civil defense efforts not only increased material production in industry and agriculture, but also kept the minds of Americans focused on the consequences of defeat and encouraged a sense of community. While this psychological aspect was only peripherally important to a few civil defense administrators, it would be magnified by successor programs and arguably became one of the founding principles of its continuation into the early Cold War. Beyond these important contributions to the war effort, civil defense also contributed to the everyday lives of many Americans. While civil defense programs often operated within the limitations of the era, Opportunities nevertheless broaden those limitations by taking an inclusive approach towards securing national security.
Great information as always. Thanks, Connie.
You're welcome.
Connie Lester is Associate Professor of History at the University of Central Florida, Director of the Riches Digital Archiving Project, and Editor of the Florida Historical Quarterly.
When you see me marching home, then we'll dawn in our land. We'll sit down under the apple tree, baby, just you and me. When I come marching home.
This is Florida Frontiers. After the Civil War, black politicians attempted to exert political power as independent candidates. Sebastian Garcia has more.
Robert D. Skelton is a PhD candidate in history at the University of North Carolina, Greensboro. He recently delivered a presentation at the 91st annual meeting of the Southern Historical Association in St. Pete Beach, Florida, titled Building a New Coalition: How Black Florida Politicians Pursued New Stakeholders to Keep Reconstruction Alive Beyond 1876. We often learn that Reconstruction ended in 1876 after the presidential election between Democratic candidate Samuel Tilden and Republican candidate Ruford B. Hayes. Robert Skelton seeks to challenge that endpoint, however, by examining the black political independent movement in Florida.
I took a look at the candidacy of J. Willis Menard. Menard was a free black man from the state of Illinois who moved to Louisiana in 1865 and then to Florida in 1871. He's perhaps best known as the first black man elected to the U.S. Congress, although he did not serve. He was not accepted by the Congress, nor was his competitor. But his coming to Florida, his becoming part of the black political establishment in the state, and yet running headlong into the controversies and the divisions of the Republican Party that had been present essentially since the new Constitution in 1868 and the Republican Party rising and taking power, he became frustrated with it. He became frustrated to the point to say, I want to set out on my own path. And Florida had had its own black congressman, Josiah Walls, who lost effectively in the convention. So Menard decided, hey, I've won a congressional seat before. I'm going to try again. He did not gain much traction. Nevertheless, it was that he stated, I want to look out after black community interests. That was his driving point. So I use that as a point of departure for all of this.
The black political independent movement offered alternatives to the Republican and Democratic parties for black Floridians during this time.
So what the independent movement offered was another path. It was a way of saying, we don't trust either party. We were looking for something else. And in addition, we're looking for somebody else who might allow us to join in a coalition, because essentially a lot of the independent movements that are rising are white led. And in Florida's case, it's not necessarily any different, even though arguably Menard is doing something that's fairly unique at this point in 1876. But it's really 1880 that I focused on, and I focused on divisions taking place in both parties. Republicans in both Duval County and in St. John's County. And then I also looked at Democrat independents in some of the coastal counties, on the Gulf coastal counties, that is. So some of the points of contention, black men, they had the right to vote. They could get elected to the state legislature. They could get elected to local offices like, say, mayor or constable for those places that had those offices. They could not get elected to county offices. They could not get elected to any of the state level like cabinet officials. All of those were handled by appointment. That was one frustration. Other frustrations included economic ones. We're starting to see a movement towards sharecropping. We're starting to see movement towards unfair contracts. And so these kind of issues give cause for people to say, well, I want these opportunities. I want to be able to run for legislature. And I don't like what either of the primary parties have to offer.
In 1884, the leaders of the Black independent movement went all in on establishing a new political coalition.
It's in 1884 where I say that the leadership goes all in. The Gainesville Conference that takes place that year includes over 70 Black representatives from counties all over the state. This is Black leadership. It's all Republican, essentially, but they're saying the Republican Party isn't going to work for us anymore. We want to make a coalition with these white independent leaders and see if we can bring them along and still maybe coalition with the Republicans after the fact, or maybe even take over that element of the Republican Party. But their vision is very much independent of the mainstream Republican as being driven out of the National Party.
Yet, Black voters did not respond to calls for a new coalition. Skelton suggests that a generational divide caused this lack of unity.
It's 1884. You've had African Americans in politics for not quite 20 years at this point. And there's been organizing going on before then, but even so, you're also starting to see what I think is kind of a generational divide. You have the older folks who maybe were in the abolition movement, who were politicking in the North prior to the Civil War, who are somebody like Robert Smalls, who is a slightly older leader, who's also now a politician, who they're the old guard, if you will. And you've got the younger generation like T. Thomas Fortune coming along where they're saying, wait a second, I think we can deal with the other party. We need to be more true to our own principles and not compromise our philosophy and our ideals away just because this party supported us in the past.
Literacy tests and other forms of voting restrictions on Black constituents limited the political independent movement.
The eight ballot box scheme, that was instead of having just one ticket with all the names on it that you put into one box, you have to have a ticket for each person that you're voting for. This forms a kind of literacy test because it requires the person voting to be able to read not only the ballot they have in front of them, but to also be able to read the box that they're putting their ballot into. Because if they put their ballot into the wrong box, say the name of the candidate is Perry, and they put Perry's ballot into the Smith box, well, whenever the person counting says, oh, I see Perry and a Smith, I throw it out. That vote doesn't count. And so as a result, it's a literacy test. There's some changes in the way that the counties handle registration in the 1880s, and they start to deny people's registration. And this is one of several things that really start to unfold in the late 1880s that are going to start to deprive African Americans and to some extent poor whites of their rights of suffrage.
For Florida Frontiers, I'm Sebastian Garcia, a graduate history student, FHS media production assistant, and history podcaster at the University of Central Florida Department of History.
You've been listening to Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society. Please join us right here again next week. Until then, find us anytime online at myfloridahistory.org. Production assistance for Florida Frontiers comes from Connie Lester and Sebastian Garcia. The program is edited by Giselle Concepcion. Have a great week. I'm Ben Brotmarkle. Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society, is made possible in part by the Department of State Division of Historical Resources and the State of Florida. It's also made possible by the Jesse Ball DuPont Fund and by the historic Rossiter House Museum and Gardens in O'Galley, celebrating pioneer history, the natural environment, and women's history. Available for weddings and events at rossiterhousemuseum.org.